Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Goodyear. Welcome to the Classic Album Club podcast. In this episode, we revisit Manic Street Preacher's powerful and emotive 1996 album, Everything Must Go.
Any song that we released that would represent a new album had to be amazing. We didn't even say that to each other. It was a very tacit understanding, but we just knew the stakes was high because people would be looking to see if we're a much lesser band without Richie.
We'll be hearing from lead singer and guitarist James Dean Bradfield about their collaboration with producer Mike Hedges and the change in routine for recording the new album.
I loved every part of being in the studio. Mike was very much an old school producer who believed in creating an environment and just everybody just really getting on. And you knew that from 10 till 6 in the day, you know, you had a good 8 hours of recording and nothing else.
First, let's hear James describe the impact that the disappearance of Richie Edwards, the band's rhythm guitarist, co-writer and creative centre point, had on the future of Manic Street Preachers.
You can't really describe how Everything Must Go came about without describing the end of The Holy Bible, the third album, and subsequently, you know, Richie's disappearance. So we'd come to the end of The Holy Bible campaign. Yeah, you know, Richie had been quite troubled up through that campaign and in the recording of The Holy Bible. And we had said to him, look, you know, you don't have to come out on the road with us anymore. Perhaps we actually even said, you know, the band doesn't have to continue. We can just try and do something else or just change name and just become more of a studio entity. We were aware that the road was quite a difficult place for somebody to put themselves in once they'd been through certain things, I suppose, is the best way of putting it. And he had turned all those things down, and so he said, no, I want to carry on, you know, especially with the music, and I've got some lyrics, and, you know, let's start writing for the next record. So we had gone to a place in Surrey called The House in the Woods, which was a little demo studio, which we'd been to before for the first album. And that was a lovely, what you would call a safe environment for somebody such as Richie, who had been through something, you know, a few traumas. And we did some demos there. Some of the songs that we did there ended up on Everything Must Go. Songs like Small Black Flowers That Grow in the Sky, Further Away was done there, No Surface or Feeling was done there. But also we'd written some songs there, which we didn't do demos of, songs like Elvis Impersonator, Blackpool Pier, and Kevin Carter were written, but they hadn't. We ran out of time to do demos of them. After that session, we drove back to the MC Hotel in Bayswater Road, and myself and Richie were supposed to go to America to do a promo tour for The Holy Bible because we were going to do an American leg of the tour for The Holy Bible. And then that was the night that he went missing. So, you know, the start of Everything Must Go was mired in Richie disappearing. There's no way around it. You know, that is the truth. So it was quite strange to look back in it and know that the start of the demoing process for Everything Must Go was really amidst this massive thing that was happening to us. I suppose we've got to jump 8 months on from that point, where we'd sat round, you know, in each other's houses and in our management's office and in rehearsal rooms, not quite knowing what our situation was, whether Richie was ever going to come back. And we didn't know whether we were still a band without him. You know, it really was, everything was so nebulous and troubled, you know. So it's a very, very weird atmosphere. After about 5 months, I think, we decided that the only thing we could do was write some songs and see how we felt. And as soon as you make a decision like that, you know that the stakes are very, very high, because you know that amidst Richie's absence and his disappearance, there are so many questions. But also that if you put yourself back into the fray as a band, you're still going to be judged on the music you release. So everything felt quite delicate. Everything felt quite just very confused. So the one thing that we did know was that any song that we released that would represent a new album had to be amazing. We didn't even say that to each other. It was a very tacit understanding, but we just knew the stakes was high because people would be looking to see if we were a much lesser band without Richie. But we just wanted to prove that undoubtedly we would be a different band, but we would still be amazing. That's the only way I could put it, really. We had written some songs, Design for Life being one of them, and we invited Mike Hedges to Cardiff to watch us rehearse. And that was interesting because we had asked Mike Hedges to produce the Holy Bible, because he'd produced some of my favourite records ever. He'd produced Story of the Blues by Wah. He'd produced a lot of Banshee stuff, a lot of Cure stuff, Associates, you know, just so many records which I loved. And he had sent us a reply at the start of the Holy Bible saying, thanks for the inquiry, I like you, but I'm really busy, but please ask me again. And that was quite strange because producers, you usually don't get an answer from them. You get an answer from their manager saying, no, I'm not interested, or they just don't answer at all. And he had sent back something quite personal and saying, sorry, I can't do it this time, but please, I want to work with you. So that was cool. So when we came around to doing everything with Musco, we thought, let's try Mike again. You know, he'd been very open to working with us. He came to Cardiff. We played him Design for Life once. Then he asked to hear it again. He obviously loved it the first time. And he said, I don't care if I don't do an album with you, but as long as I get to produce that song, that's all I want to do. He said, of course I want to do an album with you, but I really want to produce that song. And that was a really pivotal, important moment because we needed confidence. We were lacking confidence. We were lacking identity. We were lacking certainty in any kind of way. And for him to say that, and for somebody that we admired so much to say that, was a massive shot on the arm for us. We kind of quickly played him some other songs, Kevin Carter included. Then Nick and Sean went home and I took him out to a food pubs in Cardiff and we got hammered. I mean, we didn't get hammered, we got panelled. He had never drunk this Welsh beer called Brains before. And we were really, I mean, it was big, big time drunk. And Mike is 6'7" and I'm 5', five-ish kind of thing. And so it was quite a strange sight seeing me leading back to the train station. It looked like Danny DeVito and Arnie Schwarzenegger in Twins, you know. And so that was a good start. It really was a good start. And then a month later, we find ourselves in France doing our first session with him, Design for Life and Kevin Carter. And I don't know whether it was serendipity. I don't know whether it was we were dealt some good fate after what we had been through. But everything just clicked straight away. Design for Life. We and Kevin Carter, we came back and they were a mixed, but already they sounded amazing. And I remember playing them to Rob Stringer in his car and he was kind of amazed. He was just like, that's just, we've got, you know, the first track you recorded and you've got the first single. By then we started doubting ourselves, but he was always very, very definite, Rob Stringer. He said, you've kind of got the single. It's the best thing you've done since Motorcycle. Perhaps it's even better. So that's how we started. It felt like a relief to actually have things click into place with such ease. After, obviously, Richie had been in a bad place at the start of the Holy Bible, and then he disappeared. And, you know, I don't want to go over all that again. It's obvious what it is. And to have everything click into place for once, which felt like we'd been in a bad place for 2 years, really. And to have all that click into place, you know, Mike Hedges, the studio in France being an amazing environment. And the writing, you know, I mean, only yesterday I was, before I did this interview, Design for Life came on the radio. And the only thing I could concentrate on was the lyric. I don't think there are many examples in British rock pop history where every line of the song means something. And you don't hear that line in any other song. The only thing I could come up with was Eating Rifles by The Jam or Going Underground, where every line counts for something. Perhaps God Save the Queen, Pistols. You know, it's kind of every line in that song, Library gave us power, Work came and made us free. What price now for a shallow piece of dignity? I wish I had a bottle right here in my dirty face to show the scars from where I came. You know, we don't want to get drunk. We just talk about love and we are not allowed to spend because we are told this is the end. It talks about boom and bust economy. It talks about the gap between the haves and the have-nots where the haves kind of don't give a damn about tax, but, you know, the have-nots constantly preach to about not spending above their means, where there's one law for the have-nots and then there's no laws, you know, for the haves. You know, just for that, just to be covered in one line, and we are not allowed to spend because we are told that this is the end. So concise. So when I heard it yesterday, I was just thinking, oh, that's just an amazing lyric from Nick. It's absolutely pinpoint every line. Sometimes I will edit some of the lyrics down, but Nick had done that job for himself on this record. Like a song like Australia, which is a song about escapism. It's a song about just wanting to escape everything. You know, it's very concise. Design for Life is very concise. Everything must go, you know, a cathartic lyric. Trying to jettison, you know, experience for new experience is a very concise lyric too. And Nick had pretty much done that on the page himself. I didn't really have to do anything. The only editing process I had to do was put two lyrics together to make Design for Life, but both the lyrics were about the same thing anyway. And to sing those lyrics, stuff like Everything Must Go, Design for Life, Australia, it is physically easier, which I don't necessarily want. I love the challenge of the verboseness of some of our I'd love singing the songs in the Holy Bible because it's almost like a sporting challenge. It's very physical and it's very confrontational. You feel confronted by the lyric, and so it makes you sing a different way. But undoubtedly, I think a lot of the commercial success may be down to the production, may be down to the tunes, but a lot of it is down to Nick's lyrics because it gave birth to being able to produce things in a more glossy way, in a more aesthetically commercial way, I suppose. And it gave everything a chance to breathe, including myself.
It was clear that this new album was going to be different to anything that the Manics had done before. This was typified by the powerful opening track, Elvis Impersonator, Blackpool Pier.
It was really strange to hear people around us starting to describe things in different terms. I remember when we did the initial recording and it was very rough and unmixed. I remember Rob Stringer, Martin Hall, our manager, and Mike Hedges all saying that it reminded them of Queen a bit, very early Queen, which I found confusing, but people always said that I had a touch of the Mercury's in my vocal kind of thing. But that was quite interesting that people saw that. And I put the tag on the at the start, at the end, with the American Trilogy, a little pastiche at the end. Because it seemed like an obvious thing to do, to have this image of a faux version of Elvis amongst very British, dare I say, English setting. And it questions the whole validity of authenticity and what authenticity means in the modern era. I just thought it would be nice to have a part of the ghost-like image of American Trilogy at the end of it, which segues into Design for Life. So I heard that, and I heard what the lyric was trying to do. You know, it questions what authenticity is. So I wanted to make the music quite real, yeah, to counter that. But originally, when I played this song to Richie once on the acoustic guitar in the kitchen at a house in the woods, I envisaged it being like Wire, a post-punk group from the late 70s and 80s that was on the Harvest label for any train spotters out there. I pictured this song being like Want to X You by Wire, which is like doom-da-da. So it should have been, my original version was 20-foot high on Blackpool Promenade. And it was very breakneck speed, post-punk kind of song. And then I remember taking that into the rehearsal room with Nick and Sean and them saying, no, it doesn't go like that. It's got to be a bit more like some of the other songs we recorded. So I was quickly corrected by Nick and Sean. And it grew into this thing that has a touch of old-school 70s rock about it, I suppose, really. The lyrics are old-school Richie lyrics, you know, 20-foot high on Blackpool Promenade, fake royalty, second-hand sequin facade. It is very prescient. I think the secret to a lyric like that is that amongst it all, Richie is even asking the question, does authenticity even matter? That was always the sting in the tail with a Richie lyric. It wouldn't just be about the one thing, there would be the question there too.
Richie Edwards continued to be a guiding influence on the album, and the track Small Black Flowers That Grow in the Sky demonstrates the emotive power of his lyric writing.
I know the documentary. It's buried in my mind. I know the documentary that it was based upon, that Richie had watched, but I can't remember what it was called. I remember him telling me about it. Anyway, I remember him giving me this lyric, and we had done the demo. When I read the lyric, I wanted it to be like a Rolling Stones song called The Spider and the Fly. I wanted it to be quite a skeletal kind of acoustic experience. I remember all of us just loving this song, and we didn't really want to change it when we went on to master it that much. We just added the harp to it. And I remember myself and Richie driving back to the MC Hotel after the House in the Woods session, because Nick and Sean went back to Wales. Me and Richie went to the MC Hotel. And it was almost like a scene from a film. We pulled into the underground car park in his Vauxhall Astra. Oh, the glamour. I remember that song finishing as we parked, and it just stopped, and he went, "That's my favourite song we've done so far." So I know that he loved that song, which is quite, it does mean something. This song reminded me of a book I'd read by either Osamu Dazai or Kobo Abe, two Japanese authors. I can't remember which one it is. And the book is called The Lady of the Sands, or The Woman of the Dunes. There are two different titles. And it reminded me of that film is about how this woman is captured in a deep sand dune, and she's analysed and used by the village. And it's a really dark film, but it's an old black and white Japanese film. And this lyric kind of evoked that for me. So I said that to Richie, and he kind of looked into the book a bit, and he went, "Yeah, that's a good." Perhaps he was just humouring me, but he said that's a good touchstone for it. So anyway, Richie really liked this song, and then when we went to record it in France, Mike agreed. He didn't want to do much to it. He just wanted the vocal to be a lot better, because Mike was always really focused on vocals. And he wanted to harp on it. Mike's got a very grand style sometimes, whilst being very earthy, so it's a good mixture. And he said, "Oh, I know a harp player. She's a Frank Sinatra's harpist." I was like, "Oh, wow, yeah. If I can meet, you know, the lady that's played Summer Wind, which is one of my favourite songs by Frank Sinatra, then, you know, yeah, that's great for me." So he got Frank Sinatra's harpist to play in it, and he just finished it off. It was beautiful.
Another major song on the album, Kevin Carter, was rooted in Richie's creative explorations. He based the lyrics around the tragic story of the photographer of the same name.
Richie had investigated the story about Kevin Carter. They had taken a famous photograph, child dying and a vulture waiting right behind it, which you can't get away from the darkness of that. It's just unfathomably bleak, grim, and just tragic. And I think Kevin Carter had won a prize, a Pulitzer Prize, nominated, won. And this was and work that he'd done like that was the reason why he'd won that prize. And subsequently, he'd become very troubled and very conflicted about the whole thing, and he committed suicide. So, yeah, not a terrible story, really. I think we've always loved that thing of just not writing about who we love or a love song. Or I think what compels us to write songs is sometimes other people's inspiration, sometimes other people's misery, no doubt. And at least that takes you out of yourself. It takes you out of the arena of written something which is ego-driven. We wrote this song. All the references in the lyric, stuff like Bang Bang Club, is what him and a group of photographers had called themselves, because they were taking photographs in such arenas of intense conflict and stuff. So all the references in there are from Kevin Carter himself, you know. And it was, for Richie, it's a very concise lyric, very concise. But I think it's easier to write this stuff when you're younger, because you do tend to approach it feeling a little more invincible. You feel as if you can do anything. Whereas if you try to do stuff like this when you're older, you question everything. And you question the validity of just turning it into music even. Well, when you're young, you just face things face on. You know, you just go into them face on, you charge into it. So, I'm glad we tried to do all these things when we were younger, because it's you question things as you get older. I mean, Kevin Carr was a hit. It's bizarre. You know, it was a proper hit kind of thing. So, yeah, it's quite strange.
Everything Must Go was proving to be a complex and deeply emotional album that encompassed feelings of distance and isolation, as well as facing up to the disenfranchisement of the working class. Coming up in this episode of Classic Album Club.
First time we played Design for Life was supporting Stone Roses at Wembley Arena. Quite strange. I couldn't quite tell whether people connected with that song or not. I couldn't tell whether we connected with it. So suddenly we'd come from this thing of recording it and then taking it on stage in front of a Stone Roses crowd. I didn't quite know where we were. Everything Must Go, ironically, managed to kind of come into existence and be accepted because Richie was still part of the record lyrically. Undoubtedly, Richie's influence is still born upon the record, because his lyrics have influenced quite a lot of the music there. We're absolutely cursed, and we should have round about 7 number one albums now, and we've always been pipped to the post by something gigantic. I can't be magnanimous in defeats or something like that. I just can't. Sorry, I'm a bitter person. And I'm not going to go through the list. And Everything Must Go was kept off number one as well, and Design for Life was kept off number one.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Mike Hedges has fully backed the material that the band was producing throughout this period and had developed a close working relationship with them too. This was down to the disciplined and structured recording schedule that he put in place.
Up until then, I loved every part of being in the studio, but I knew that at 6 o'clock, it would just be me and the producer and I'd go on till 2 a.m. Mike structured things in a bit of a different way. We're at a place called Chateau Rougemont in Domfront, which is in Normandy. A very classic, kind of like, you know, French rambling chateau. With slightly faded grandeur about it. Mike would demand that we started around about 10 in the morning, which usually I started about midday, and I'd go on till 2 a.m. He said that we had to start at 10 in the morning, and then we would finish just before dinner. So when the session started, dinner would start around about 8. And that was okay. Then dinner would start again, pushed forward to around about 6. Dinner would be enormous. You know, there would be 3 bean soups, super pea stew. There would be just beef bourguignon. There would just be, you know, just coq au vin. There would just be flans. There would just be everything, you know, meats, just like, you know, cured fish. Nick really, this is where Nick hit his wine phase. He really got into wine. And there would just be beautiful bread and hams and cheese in the fridge. I never recovered from it. I've been a chunky Labrador ever since, you know. And yeah, you would work till, you'd start at 10 and then you'd finish at, suddenly dinner would be at 6. And you would be so, you'd have such post-meal slump that you'd immediately have a sleep. You'd wake up, it'd be 9. And then you'd go to the pub, or I would go to the pub and Nick and Sean would stay in the house. Sean would come out now and again. So in the end, it worked out because we were starting earlier and you knew that from 10 till 6 in the day, you know, you had a good 8 hours of recording and nothing else.
The song Australia sounds bright and powerful, but it tackles feelings of being alone and escapism that bassist Nicky Wire was experiencing in the early 90s.
Nick had had a few health issues as well. His liver wasn't working the way it should. So he'd go into these slumps where he would just have to just fall asleep for 5 hours. You know, so he was quite ill for a short period there. And I think we'd come out the other end of, obviously, Richie's disappearance, and Nick had had this thing which was undiagnosed. And he'd written me written this lyric, and he said, this is just a song about escape. It's just one, me about just, it's my life on Mars. You know, I'm just, you know, if I think about escaping some way, so it's to Australia. I don't know why. It's a very simple lyric. I think shortly after that, he said, I read this really good Paul McCartney and John Lennon quote where they said, should we do a swimming pool song? And what they meant by that was, yeah, we've had a couple of big songs, but let's write something really big. Let's write something where we can buy another mansion with a swimming pool or something. And I said, well, what would our version of that be? I think we came up with Let's Write a kind of Goals of the Month song. We could write something which could constantly be played behind sporting montages or clips or goal roundups. And that's quite a really shallow way of approaching something. But I like the idea of just approaching something that just trying to create this, like, this shiny musical moment which could just get played in sporting programs and stuff. And I like the idea of just, the lyric was about escapism, very simple. And I like the idea of just approaching the tune from a very simple point of view, something that was just shiny and that just summed up, like, what's happened this week in sport kind of thing. And it worked. It got used on the nationwide league's goal roundup for about 4 years. Which was that really made me happy. It was nice to actually approach something in a very much more shallow, simple way, and to have it work was great. Australia nearly didn't make it. We had done a version of Australia with Stephen Haigh, who produced, you know, Regret by New Order, and it not by anybody's fault. Sometimes it just doesn't work out, which just goes to show the chemistry between you and a producer can be nearly as important as the chemistry between a band. You know, And then Stephen Egg was brilliant, and he was great to us, and he'd done some amazing records, but it didn't work out with us. So we re-recorded a version with Mike Hedges, and again, it didn't feel brilliant. And it was just about not to make the record, and we gave it to Dave Eringer to mix, who we'd done the second album with, and we recorded both our number ones with subsequently. He mixed it, and it turned out all right. And that was a great relief, it was. Girl I Want to Be God was a really good amalgam between Nick and Richie. It's where they wrote lyrics together for this one. Or Nick added lyrics to it later. And it needed it because it was a bit of a mess. But we knew something was there. And I think the lyric is loosely based on Sylvia Plath, or the cult of Sylvia Plath. You know, we thought, yeah, this could be our ABBA lyric kind of thing. Because there were lines in there which just jumped up from the page, which just seemed quite ABBA-esque, which is just so misguided from us. Myself, Nick and Sean knew that we loved the idea of this song, and we just needed Nick to really add lots to it. So it's a very much a 50-50 experience lyrically between Nick and Richie. And yes, important. A lot of people have always said that this is one of their favourite songs off the record. And again, this is the one surviving bit from the Stephen Haig session. We did this song with Stephen Haig. We took it away, and we knew that the bedrock of what he'd done was good, but we had to work on it with Mike Hedges as well. So, in a roundabout way, this one got finished. We were aware of a section of our crowd that were very much in thrall to the Holy Bible. It's very strange, you know. The first album was kind of big, you know, especially with Motorcycle Emptiness. Second album took that inevitable second album dip. But then the third album sold less than the second and the first album. But in a strange way, we seemed bigger. It seemed like we were the biggest cult band in Britain, because our gigs were selling out, and suddenly our audience were turning up en masse, dressed in this military regalia and sailors' outfits and stuff and everything, you know, all the stuff that we were wearing. So we were aware that kind of like, you know, a lot of our crowd were very, very strictly adherent to what the Manic Street Preachers was about, and that was the Holy Bible. Suddenly this became the touchstone for what the Manics should be. So when we came to release Design for Life and Everything Must Go, we were aware of this section of the crowd that only wanted to see the Holy Bible version of of Manic Street Preachers, or wanted to see what Richie represented. And we didn't know how they were going to react to songs like Design for Life, Kevin Carter, Everything Must Go. So that's touched upon in the lyric, you know, we just hope that you forgive us because everything must go. We were aware that there could be a disconnect between what people thought was our defining moment, the Holy Bible, and this. Everything Must Go, ironically, managed to kind of come into existence and be accepted because Richie was still part of the record lyrically, you know. And so my biggest influence in the group is the lyrics that are put in front of me. So at the start, it was just Nick giving me the lyrics. Then very quickly became Nick and Richie giving me lyrics. And then it was just Nick again. And no matter in what form, whether it be from day one or to the very first song we wrote for Everything Must Go, the biggest influence for me in the group is the lyrics that are put in front of me, whether it be from Nick or Richie. And undoubtedly, Richie's influence is still born upon the record, because his lyrics have influenced quite a lot of the music there.
From early in the development of their hit song, A Design for Life, James had identified the expansive, richly layered sound he wanted to achieve.
When we wrote Design for Life, it pretty much came as it was recorded, minus the strings. It was all formed from verse, bridge to chorus. It was Nick's idea just to have the instrumental section in the middle, where there were no words and just a verse repeated, but with the strings cascading down. You know, that song was envisaged without any producer touching it. And then, you know, Mike just made it sound better. And we knew he could do that, actually, because he just produced Yes by McCalmont and Butler. So that was a bit of serendipity that he'd produced something which we wanted one of our songs to sound like. We were definitely going that direction of just wanting to breathe, of wanting to perhaps be able to fly from the orbit of super reality. You know, we wanted, not necessarily in the lyrics, but we wanted there to be some kind of escapism in the lyrics, where we just wanted to be uplifted, I suppose, by our own music, rather than be confronted by the reality of what we created. It's really simple. So it would have happened anyway, but I think Mike was undoubtedly the perfect choice for it.
Although creativity was freely flowing and the band was clicking in the studio, James still had doubts about how the new material would be received live.
The first time we played Design for Life was supporting Stone Roses at Wembley Arena. That was strange. I remember Nick wore a Cardiff Red Devils ice hockey shirt on stage, which was bizarre in itself. I wore some nondescript kind of like Manic's CNA top. It was quite strange. I couldn't quite tell whether people connected with that song or not. I couldn't tell whether we connected with it. So suddenly we'd come from this thing of recording it and then taking it on stage in front of a Stone Roses crowd. I didn't quite know where we were. Then the next gig we did after that, I think, was we did a warm-up gig for supporting Oasis at Main Road at the Hacienda the night before. And Nick pretty much had a bit of an emotional breakdown that night. It just hit home that Richie not being there. And then we played the Main Road gig. And after the thing of supporting Stone Roses and doing the Hacienda warm-up gig, we stepped on stage at Main Road to support Oasis, and it did click with the audience. Again, that was another moment of relief. It was just like, you know, there were lads there, you know, lots of lads, you know, kitted out in Man City tops. You know, it was massive at the time. Two nights at Main Road, you know, that was big. And then it got bigger, obviously. But suddenly you're watching these lads, and they're proper football lads. Good boys, you know. But they were like, oh, yeah, have you heard this one? It's good. Yeah, it's a good song, this. Yeah, don't mind this. And then they listened to Motorcycle Emptiness, and then they listened to us play From Despair Away. And you realise that, you know, Design for Life had grabbed everybody's attention. So, again, it was up and down, up and down, up and down. A couple of weeks before, I wasn't quite sure whether Design for Life was going to do it. And then I was like, yeah, it will do it, definitely. We should have round about 7 number one albums now, and we've always been pipped to the post by something gigantic or improbably big, like, you know, The Greatest Showman on this record, keeping us off number one. When we would have been number one every other week, except for that. I can't be magnanimous in defeats or something like that. I just can't. Sorry, I'm a bitter person. And Everything Must Go was kept off number one as well. And Design for Life was kept off number one. I kind of accept Design for Life being kept off number one because it was kept off number one by Genius Pop Record. If you're kept off number one by something which you respect, that makes it easier to lose. But being number one does matter. And we've missed out on so many number one records now just by something just flourishing and just coming from the ground up and beating us, pipping us at the post. And it happened with Design for Life. And it's weird because Design for Life sold so many records, you know, as a single. And it hung around in the charts for ages, but it was never number one. And Everything Must Go was never number one. But we got the Brit Award for Best Album, you know, and it sold 1.3 million in Britain alone, just in Britain. So, yeah, those are the days where when you had success, commercial success, across-the-counter, money-changing hands success, things just stayed around in the charts forever, you know. And there was a certain longevity to that. People always equate being rampantly commercially successful with that perhaps is a sellout to it, but there was a longevity to it, you know, there was. Things just kept connecting with people. You know, we had the Ivan Novello for Best Contemporary Song for Design for Life, which is probably one of my most favourite moments in the band. You know, is Ivan Novello, famous Welshman thing, and I'm getting that for Best Contemporary Song is one of the biggest things you can get, and we got it for Design for Life. So it all added up in the end. You know, a lot of people say, "Oh, wasn't Britpop like, you know, oh, everything got pigeonholed?" I always get very confused when people look back at it like that. I was like, well, there was just lots of really good guitar music around, and lots of lyrically, things were quite interesting, you know? And he just had true working-class expression with Oasis. Regardless what you think of Oasis, which mostly I just think they're genius a lot of the times, it was working-class rage. Do you see that happening much now? In the charts, in the top 10, being number one, ruling the world? No, you don't. South London does a good job of representing, like, working-class rage, but nowhere else at the moment. So, you know, don't look back at it and think, oh, everything was pigeonholed. Don't be such a doofus, you know. It was a good time.
Many thanks to Manic Street Preachers singer and guitarist James Dean Bradfield. I'm Mark Goodyear. You've been listening to Classic Album Club.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.